Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And what's it going to take, folks? What is it going to take? We've got warfare tactics being used by our government against we the people, against our the governments we have instituted, and they're supporting, they are the driving force for the global agenda. I mean, the digital currency for the world has been introduced. Everything is coming out, and it's all being unfolded. And what are we going to do? Well, we're actually giving you, starting this year, we're going through the same curriculum, but what we're trying to do is we're trying to lay it all out so that you have a clear understanding of what are the type of government we have, the form of government that we have, and you know, how we got this government. Because one of the biggest confusions, and forgive me, this may not be that funny, but when I talk to people, and there are a lot of people that are teaching people what I would just say as contrary doctrine to the Constitution or to the truth, contrary to the truth. That, let's go with that. Because there are people that are supporting paths and systems and or arguments that are not founded on the truth. Those who are out there, Anna von Ritz, anybody that is supporting the Jural Assembly, anybody that is supporting the Sovereign Citizen Movement, sorry, folks, they're not presenting you the truth. They're basically presenting to you that we never adopted, we never evolved into a more perfect, if not a completely perfect, government system. They're basically teaching you that we still function underneath our monarchical form of government, under the doctrine of magistrates and the doctrine of lesser magistrates. And that's not true. We abandoned that form of government. As a matter of fact, when we dive into this coming week, and on Monday, what I'm going to do is I'll set the case, because I've already worked it out. Paul won't be here Monday, but he'll be here Tuesday. And so Paul and I, because I know Paul has wanted to get engaged in very specific content. And so based on schedules, he won't be available. But that lends an opportunity for me to help cover some details that will take us from the Articles of Association into the Articles of Confederation. Now, you've heard right here, we actually read the Articles of Association. We've talked about, you know, this whole process of how they created this Continental Congress. And when they did this, they were functioning within that monarchical form of government. Jural assemblies, you know, the people assembling to basically stand, to resist tyranny from the king. It was all really laid out very well. It's all a part of Blackstone's commentaries, which stands as evidence, which stands as an indictment that Blackstone commentaries and that process doesn't exist under this constitutional republic. We've got 200 years beyond, and there's not one person, not one person has gone out and actually created a correction or created a guidebook, a legal guidebook of how to function in this hybrid constitutional republic. And as a matter of fact, I am pointing out as we've gone through this, some of the things that, as a matter of fact, let me be clear. These things have not come as, you know, a revelation. These things have been exposed as we have dug and dug and dug. In other words, back in 2013, I had no clue of the importance of having a county constitution. And now I know today, without any question, with full assurity, that if you do not have a constitution delegating the powers that you want to be, you know, exercised by this government that you institute, then when you form that government, you're creating a government with general powers, which is why if you understand the difference between a general power of attorney and a specified or an enumerated power of attorney, then you should have clarity in understanding why we never form governments with general powers. The framers were very clear that the voluminous comments throughout the ratification debates really centered around that very argument. This is how they actually passed the ratification of the Constitution through all of these different states, by arguing that if it is not enumerated, they can't do it. So if you understand the simplicity of functioning under a limited power of attorney, then you can understand the importance of actually having a constitutional county. There are some very specific things. See, when people want to go out and say, oh, well, we create, you know, all of these people who have created a process that if you pay them, you could be certified as a constitutional. I mean, that's almost as saying, why don't you go online and, you know, apply for the priesthood so that you can marry people and you could be a person of a clergy of your own faith, create your own faith so that you can marry people and do that kind of thing. Does that mean that you're a man of God? Does that mean you really have his priesthood? Does that really mean that you're there? Yeah, in this virtual makeup world, you know, we can be anything we want to be. And we're actually seeing this being basically permeated in our education system to teaching our children that they can, you know, they'll just be whatever they want to be. It's that insidious. So going forward, and actually what I want to do is I want to actually talk about the Electoral College, because it's Feedback Friday and I'm going to dive into that. But what I was just going to say is I'm going to give you some details that kind of led us from the Articles of Association into the Articles of Confederation and why it was so important. Because obviously, when they created the Articles of Association in 1774, that was really just a position. As we read that for you, it was just a position that the states were going to do these things. And it literally forced the hand. And as a matter of fact, in 1774, this is when they were coming to the aid of Massachusetts. And it got worse in Massachusetts. The shot that was heard around the world hadn't even occurred yet. That's how bad it was getting in Massachusetts, which goes back to the irony I was kind of commenting with Paul. Isn't it ironic that the most proudful state, the most proudful people, look how far they have fell? And as a matter of fact, they're equally proud today in evil things. They're equally proud in those things that God has told us to stay away from. So anyway, let's get into some feedback for today, because one of the things that I haven't really gotten into, and we talked about this for the past couple of years at the beginning of the year regarding the presidential election, and this is a presidential election. And so what we want to do is we really want to dive into the Electoral College. Now, when I read the Constitution, we actually dove into the Electoral College. And we've read that very, you know, the process very specific of what is supposed to happen and what actually happens under the 12th Amendment. Because, see, there was a problem in 1800. The Electoral College really couldn't come up with a majority. And so they made it simple. They simplified the process, folks. But I can't talk about the Electoral College without talking about apportionment, because the Electoral College is directly tied to apportionment. And so when we look at the Constitution, the Constitution created this, I'll just say, this hard, rigid part of our government was representation. In other words, the apportionment of representation for the people was set to not exceed 30,000 persons, 30,000 citizens. Now, to be clear, in Article 1, Section 2 of the Constitution, this is exactly what the apportionment, the clause states. The number of representatives shall not exceed one representative, for every 30,000. Now, what does that mean? 30,000 what? 30,000 blue-eyed men? No. 30,000 what? 30,000 people. Now, this is why they didn't really clearly specify 30,000. Most everybody knew it was 30,000 people. It was presumed. And as a matter of fact, I have not, when we go through the ratification debates, this becomes one of the key things we'll expose for you, because I've never really gotten into how well this was covered between the states. I've covered lots of other things. And so what we want to do is kind of go through that so that you can see how they defined this apportionment, because it was clear there was this tie to apportionment for taxation as well as representation. Huh, isn't that interesting? Does that sound familiar? Remember the Revolutionary War? No taxation without representation? That was a right of an Englishman. You can't tax me unless I have representation. We moved forward with some of those very same principles baked into our Constitution, that a state could not be taxed, or I should say a territory could not be taxed. It had to transition into a state to where it received representation, it received apportionment, and in that apportionment, it received a tax bill based on the people. And that it was the same calculation. If it was, you know, $100 a head, then however many heads you had in your state, the state paid $100 per person in that state as the apportionment for the functioning of the federal government. And they were just fine working that way, representing 30,000 people. They were growing and growing in size, and they were still somewhat staying within their means. It wasn't until the federal government started actually spending things, spending money and spending tax dollars on things they had no authority to spend on. So this is why we want to make sure that we lay out specifically how important representation is when we talk about our government. Some people say that a huge government is unwieldy and you can't control it. Well, that's true if it is a government that is outside your control. In other words, if you allow your government to grow the way the government wants to grow, in other words, create standing armies, create all of these powers to themselves, all these roles and responsibilities, and actually be able to seize any property that they want. But we don't have that kind of government. We have a government that is enumerated very specific with these powers. It's enumerated with these roles, these responsibilities, as well as these properties. They can't create a national forest until they amend the Constitution. And yet they have national forests from sea to shining sea. So As we look at the Article 2, or not Article 2, that's where the Electoral College is. I want to get back to Article 1. As we look at this 30,000 people, we look at the apportionment in Article 1 as for representation, but it also speaks as electors. And it really clarifies how the electors are to be chosen, because the electors for the most numerous branch have the same requirements as the body of the most numerous branch. In other words, I didn't state that right. Let me say it this way. The House of Representatives is, and the prerequisites to be eligible to be a representative in Congress, that is the standard for an elector. So when you look at Article 1 and you lay out what that requirement is, it's a pretty low bar. But I believe you have to be, and I think it goes into this in probably Section 2 or Section 3, but it lays out that you have to be a citizen, and I believe you have to be a citizen of 25 years old. And I'll actually go through this. As a matter of fact, a senator has to be 35 years old. And when we look at the number for the most numerous branch, I'm pretty sure. I don't memorize this stuff that well, but I do remember that I believe the qualifications have to be 25 years old. Yeah, it's right there in Article 2, Section, or Article 1, Section 2. Age of 25 years and have been 7 years a citizen of the United States. Now, this is the same standard for an elector. And the electors are equal to Congress, the number in Congress. So in other words, every state gets 2 electors for every senator. So that's 2. Every state gets 2 senators. And however many representatives in Congress, you get 1 elector for each of them. So in other words, the Electoral College, or your electors that you are to choose and vote for, well, that equates to how many people your state has representation in Congress. Now, when I say your state has representation, I want to be clear. Your 2 senators in the Senate are to represent your state legislature. They're not there to represent the globalist agenda. They're not there to represent the party or any agenda other than the state legislature's agenda, because they are there to exercise the state legislator's suffrage. In a Republican form of government, suffrage is everything. In other words, your representative that represents you and your congressional district in the House of Representatives, they're there to actually vote your way. So the point is, as we start looking and why we wanted to make sure how we had 30,000 representatives to represent the people, the framers were very clear, and I've already said this, and we've already kind of covered this, that at the beginning of on the last day of the Constitution, they were getting ready to sign. The beginning of this process of signing the Constitution, they made one last change. And that last change was changing the Constitution from saying 40,000 and reducing it to 30,000, not to exceed 30,000, because it was debated before, and it was brought up one more time, the final time, right before they signed it. And they all agreed that it needed to change. It was unanimous that they wanted to reduce it, because they knew the more people that one person had to represent, the less representation you as a person would get. And they were very concerned about that. So they wanted to make sure that the people had better representation, not for a democracy purpose, but to ensure that if you were being harmed, that you at least had a better voice, that you could actually acquire more attention, or the opportunity to have attention, than being swallowed up in a sea of a million people that your representative has to represent. So when it comes to this form of government and our Electoral College, I have to emphasize that we, when we talk about the Electoral College, we need to talk about what the adequate representation is. Now, I've actually laid out, I've looked at the counties of America, and do you know how many counties in America have at a minimum 50,000 people? Almost 1,000. In other words, when you look at the counties, every county in America would have a rep, one-third, just a little less than one-third of all the counties throughout America would have at least one representative. That's a lot more than what you currently have. As a matter of fact, the congressional district that I live in, there's nine counties being represented by one person. Do you think I'm being represented? Do you think you're being represented? The interest of your county being represented? No. Oh, well, it's a smear. I'm going to tell you, when you really look at the diversity of these counties, this is not adequate at all. But more importantly, when we really look at the size, and I want to argue on this, and I've only got 3 minutes to kind of argue this, and when we come back, I'll dive into the Electoral College and the process of choosing the president and what we have to do. So when we look at the scope of government, the scope of government is contained by the Constitution. In other words, they only have these powers. Now, when we look at what the powers that they have, do they really need to meet so many days out of the year to discuss the foreign trade? Is our foreign trade that complex that if we actually expand, let's go by the numbers, and if we actually expanded verbatim for, let's boil it down to U.S. citizens that are eligible to vote. Because we got to understand, what is that to exceed? Is that to exceed every person? Does a representative represent the unborn, or do they represent the people who vote for them? Do they represent the children? Does the children have a voice for representation? Technically, no. A child is awarded, and legally at this point in time, the way we have laid it out, all states in the union have determined that a child doesn't have a voice and cannot be emancipated. There are maybe some conditions, but I'm telling you right now, folks, you got to understand, in the state of Washington, they're trying to emancipate all children. The children don't need to go through a legal process, that they're no longer, you know, under the jurisdiction, or they're not, the parental responsibilities are being removed. The state is taking control of all. And so in Washington state, we're actually seeing how this is getting very, very perverted. But based on the laws throughout every state in the union, a child, the parents are fully accountable and responsible for their children, legally and in every way. And so technically, the only people that should actually have representation would be those who would be either able to vote, and or at least those who are able to petition. Now, I believe, so I'm an I will argue, and I'm an advocate for changing our voting from 18 years of age to 21, or to at least a point where somebody, you know, has become a property owner, or at least has some skin in the game, as Obama talks about, right? And Obama's used that term very specifically, skin in the game. So we really need to, this is why discussing these things as the states, and this is why going through the ratification base, we really need to understand how we define these very specific things, and how well was this defined in the ratification debates on, you know, who these people are representing. Are they actually representing the children? And I don't think so. I do not think that that was the case, because out the gate, they were really looking at the adults. And then they started going, well, maybe it's just the voters. And then they started playing games of who could vote, and they reduced that. And so then they started playing. There's always been these shenanigans by the states. I've told you this time and time again. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so what I did was I pulled up the number, because you can go to the U.S. Census of 2020, and they actually break it out by county. They will tell you your county population. And so if you actually look at 30,000 people, like I said, and I go all the way to throughout this to where the 30,000 delimiter is, 1,435 counties out of how many? What's the total? A total of 3,143. So that's almost 50% of the counties with 30,000 people. In other words, half of America would have true representation in choosing their president. This is why I'm telling you, you cannot separate the Electoral College from apportionment for representation. Because you get an elector for your congressional district, and you get an elector for your Senate representation. Now, I believe when I looked at how the Electoral College was done, when they finally standardized, and this is going to be in Why Counties Matter Most article, because I actually have an appendix in the Why Counties Matter Most. And let me see here. Do I even have that up? No, I don't have it up. So I'll pull it up then. So when we really look at, you know, how many, actually how the states voted during the Electoral College processes, during the national election for choosing of the president, at the very beginning, each state was redefining, or actually they interpreted the Electoral College differently. This is important. Why is this important? Because when we look at why the states actually started going down that path of, you know, interpreting, you know, this process, that they actually started deviating because, well, I'll get to it when we get into the Constitution. When we look at the appendix that I have in Why Counties Matter Most, you'll notice in 1788, there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different methodologies being used. Now, interestingly enough, well, actually 5 different, because 2 of the states did not participate in it. So that was the 6th. But as we went through the choosing of the president, we realized that the states were not uniform in how they were applying. So if you lived in one state, you may not have even had an opportunity to choose the president. As a matter of fact, many of the states started actually thinking that the state legislature could actually determine who the electors were. Now, this flies in the face of all of this. This is why we drill into this. And this is why when we look at the Electoral College, I go into this in Why Counties Matter Most, how was the Electoral College defined? Well, the Electoral College during the ratification debates was defined this way, that when you looked at the state of, and I believe this is the state of Massachusetts, the Reverend Peter Thatcher stated, the president is, so in other words, when they were explaining the process of the Electoral College to the state, they defined it thusly, or this is how they stipulated it. The president is chosen by the electors who are appointed by the people, not the state legislators. And we're going to get into the language of this, but when we look at how Governor Randolph stated this, the mode of their election must induce us to believe that they will be men of experience and information. This is Governor Randolph on the Virginia ratification base. He said, the state will be laid off and divided into 10 districts. From each of these, a man is to be elected. He, the elector, must be really the choice of the people. In other words, you, folks, are to choose your elector, just like you are to choose your representative. Now, today, when we look at the process, well, let me go a little bit further. In the Anti-Federalist, not in the Anti-Federalist, it was stated by James Madison that instead of this, so he laid out all of these electors, and he goes, instead of this, the people choose their electors. This is just a very succinct part of his argument, but he's laying out in supporting this whole concept that we, the people, are to choose our electors. Mr. Iredell, during the North Carolina ratification debate, said this, by the proposed Constitution, the president is of a very different nature from a monarch. He is to be chosen by electors appointed by the people. I mean, it was very consistent that we were to choose our representatives. We had two representatives that we chose. In other words, you've been robbed representation in the choosing of your government. And how has that happened? Well, let's dive into the Constitution. So when we look at Article 2, Section 1, this is how it lays out the Electoral College. As a matter of fact, the very first part, the very first paragraph is literally just, you know, the statement that the president is vested with the executive authorities. The second paragraph is where it begins. Each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct a number of electors. In other words, they will appoint in the manner, not the outcome. So in other words, the electors cannot be chosen by the state legislature. That would be the outcome. That the selection of electors shall be, each state shall appoint in each manner as the legislatures may thereof, or thereof may direct, a number of electors equal to the whole number of senators and representatives to which the state may be entitled. But no senator or representative or person holding an office of trust or profit under the United States shall be appointed an elector. So that's kind of a qualification addition instead of not just being 25 years of age and a citizen of 7 years. They can't also have any employment or emoluments from the United States government. Okay, so who is to choose them? Well, it was already defined in the ratification or clarified during the ratification debates. It was we the people. But they never really talked about the apportionment and those types of details. Well, it's not that they didn't. We have to go through and dig that out of the ratification debates just to prove to you, you know, how they did define it or if they failed to. If they failed to, then guess what has to happen? No, this doesn't go to the Supreme Court for the Supreme Court to choose how they want to interpret it. There are still parties to this compact, and only the parties can actually define what that is. The parties could actually take a stand and say, we disagree with the court. The court is not the final arbiter. The states are the final arbiters when it comes to that constitution. Not we the people, our state legislatures. This is why we go through all of this in the details. But the rest of the Electoral College Clause was basically amended by the 12th Amendment. And so the 12th Amendment kind of lays out the argument of what is to happen with the electors. And this is how the 12th Amendment reads. The electors shall meet in their representative states and vote by ballot for president and vice president, one of whom at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves. Now, that line right there has been interpreted by everybody that says you cannot have a president and vice president from the same state. That is not what that says. That only states that the electors have to choose out of the two that they vote for. Each elector must choose somebody else. In other words, you could have 50% of your electors choose, you know, one person and choose another person out of state, but they all could be choosing, you know, basically 50% choosing the president and the other 50% choosing the vice president, all residents of the state, and they flip-flop on the person that's out of state. But that doesn't mean that those two people cannot be president from within their state. What I am telling you is that if you look at, let's just say Florida, because DeSantis and Trump are out on the ballot. Right now, they're nominees and they're basically candidates running for president. They could be president and vice president. The Constitution only constrains the Florida electors that they can't choose both presidents. In other words, the electors, if they chose to divide themselves and say, you know, you guys take Trump for president and we will take, you know, the DeSantis for president, and then you guys choose, or for vice president, DeSantis for vice president, and then you choose somebody else for the president or for the vice president. But problem is, everybody always focuses on the president, but all the rest of the states could actually choose, because if you're living in New York and you're an elector in New York, you could choose, because it only says that at least one person cannot be from your state. If you choose two people from outside your state, that's fair game. It doesn't say that you have to choose two people from different states. It says that you can't choose two people from your own state, that one person has to be outside of your state. So laying this out, 49 states could all choose Trump and DeSantis as the president and vice president. Now, can the electors actually choose who they want? Absolutely. There's nowhere in here, when we read through this and the process, we will prove to you that they do not have to vote per the party line. As a matter of fact, we're going to read through the process to show you that the party has no control over the electors, that the state legislature has to basically put ballots out with your electors' names. You're not to choose the president via ballot. Only the electors choose the president. In other words, this whole concept of the popular vote is not within the Constitution. So why is this important, by the way? Well, let me get into this, because I promised Paul I would dive into this. So this is how it goes further. It basically says, they shall name in their ballots the person voted for president. And in distinct ballots, in other words, they'll have two separate ballots, the person voted for as vice president. And they shall make lists of all persons, you know, at the state level, they will make a list of all persons voted for as president and all persons voted for as vice president. And the number of votes for each, which list they shall sign and certify and transmit. So all they do is they vote and they create this list, they sign and certify it and send it off to Congress. Of the government of the United States, directed to the president of the Senate, which is the current vice president. The president of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and the House of Representatives, open all certificates, and the votes shall be counted. The person having the greatest number of votes for president shall be the president. If the number of a majority of whole numbers of electors appointed, and if no person have such majority, then from the persons having the highest numbers, not exceeding three. In other words, whatever the highest numbers of all of the votes cast for president, whatever it is, not exceeding three. So let's say we had 40, because and most people look, wow, if you have that big of an electoral college, you could actually have, you know, 40 presidents. By the way, I can't imagine anybody really running for vice president. Every candidate out there would be a presidential nominee. I mean, do you really want a campaign that I don't want to be the president? I just want to be the second guy in charge. So the concept of a president choosing his running mate flies in the face of the Electoral College. The Electoral College is to choose who they believe would serve that president best. And when it was Lincoln, they felt that the Southern Johnson would actually be a better vice president, because we would have a North and South representation instead of picking two people from the North. Had Lincoln been able to choose his running mate at that point in time, then, you know, it would have been probably two people from the North, and it probably would have caused more of a ruckus. So the wisdom of the electors in actually choosing a Northern and Southern, you know, representation in the executive for president and vice president was somewhat brilliant, but it was still a signal to the South that, you know, they had to secede over slavery. But nonetheless, when we look at what's going on today, are you voting for your elector? First off, no, you're not. Are you voting for, are you actually voting for the president? Because that's not what's supposed to happen. The electors are to vote for the president. They're supposed to write those on the ballots. Your president is not to be on your ballot. Your elector is to be on your ballot. You choose the electors and they choose. The whole point behind all of this, folks, was that the electors were to campaign. They were the ones that actually said, I will vote for the person who is out to support the Constitution. Or in Obama's case, where I'm going to vote for the guy that's going to shred the Constitution and violate it and, you know, push us further into communism. Those are the dialogues that should have been happening. The reason why we had an electoral college was the system didn't facilitate the way this union was. It was so big that it wasn't even fathomable that Washington and the rest of these men would have the means of being able to travel the entire union from, you know, the northern states down to Georgia. And as it started expanding to the west, even without the railroads and without with airports and everything else, how were they to campaign? How were they to actually get in front of the people? It was the electors who did the campaigning. It was the electors who laid out, as they were getting the positions and everything else, they were to actually educate you and tell you how they would vote. And you would be able, basically, they're proving to you how well they're going to vote for you and how well they understand these issues, so that they can choose the best for the nation, for you in our representative government. We are not to have a direct election. The only direct election that we have are those people to represent us, either in the law, which is Congress, or in the representative, which is why I turn to the Supreme Court and I look at our federal system and I go, where is our representation there? We have representation in the executive and the legislative by our electors and by our representatives. But where is our judges? And I believe this is a part of the paradigm of they're above all of us, which I'm telling you, the reason why we've been pushed down this international law and all of these things that the Supreme Court has inflicted upon us is because they truly believe that they're better than us, truly believe that they know more, and they're doing what's best for us, not what they have the constitutional authority to do. They've been bending and violating the Constitution, and they have probably been the single most, destructive body regarding our government. Out of the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary has done more damage in growing government and supporting unconstitutional government. So it's about time we really start examining that. And this is where we have to have these conversations. You know, this shouldn't be done in a bubble. This should be actually outright. I mean, I think everybody needs to, and as a matter of fact, especially your representatives, they all need to be hearing what you have to say. And then they actually have to, you know, start articulating a path forward in creating a representative judiciary. Isn't that amazing? That was the one. If there was any flaw within the Constitution, that would have been it. But actually, if everybody lived by the Constitution and lived the letter of the law, we wouldn't even be in this mess. But the judiciary started aggrandizing themselves and nobody held them accountable. This is why it's so critical that we hold people accountable. So going through the Electoral College process today, the parties, as I prove in Why Counties Matter Most, when you look at 1832, 1836, every state in the Union, and I seriously mean this, every state in the Union, in my appendix, in Appendix A, you can actually see by 1832, we basically had every state in the Union, because in 1832, the only state that, two states actually deviated. And I don't know how many states, I'd have to look that up to tell you how many it was. But when you look at Maryland, Maryland is divided into electoral districts with one or more electors chosen per district by the voters. In other words, Maryland was still having the voters choose. So in other words, the only state that was not allowing you, the voter, to choose your elector was South Carolina. Each elector was appointed by the state legislature. In other words, they denied your suffrage and representation in choosing the president. The concept of a state legislature giving your party or even themselves the authority to choose who will represent you in choosing the president has been a violation of the Constitution from the very beginning. When we look at every other state, all other states, each elector was chosen by voters in a statewide ballot. In other words, you know, you had, let's say you had 20 electors based on your House of Representatives and the Senate. Then there would be there'd be 50 names and you were to choose 20 of them. In other words, it was like voting for your governor. They let everybody choose the elector that they wanted out of the field of electors. I believe that back in those days, they had a problem in printing to be able to distribute and everything else, and they felt that it was easier to do statewide elections than it was to actually give everybody their own representation and control. Because when we look at all of the different electors that were out there in each of the counties and how long did it take back in those days, they probably didn't have the processes, but we have the ability today to make sure that your representation is being protected, that your suffrage in choosing the president is absolutely your suffrage. And it flies in the face, this winner take all. Now, when we look at the language, because this is, I'm bringing this back to apportionment. The apportionment clearly states 30,000, not to exceed 30,000. Oh, well, Congress isn't tied to that. Congress doesn't have to give you your representation. They've given it upon themselves to change that. And this is what we expose to you in Why Counties Matter Most. Now, let me just say this. Why doesn't the president just assume he doesn't need advice and consent from the Senate when he chooses his nominees and actually seats his justices? The Constitution says that he has to get advice and consent. But if the state legislature, or I should say if Congress, can ignore your representation, then why can't the president ignore their voice in who he nominates and who he puts on the benches? Why is it important that we follow this part of the Constitution, but not that part? You see my point? We're not following the Electoral College. We're not following this. I can come up with scenarios left and right. I'll give you another one. the state legislatures are choosing your electors. And they basically came out and said, winner take all. Your representation in choosing the president doesn't matter. Whatever party gets the most amount of votes as a democracy, 50% plus one, then the entire state goes towards the Democratic electors. Well, let's say your state legislature does the same thing for your congressman. Why not? They're your representatives too. Why this? There's no way we, the voters, would stand for that. And there's no reason why we should be standing for letting our state legislatures choose who is going to be your elector based on a party ballot. The Constitution doesn't allow parties to be involved. It's about representation. It's about a Republican form of government, not a party form of government. But the parties, basically, and I documented it here, when we get to 1856, this is when the Democrat and Republican party primaries began. And down the road, they started doing more and more nefarious things in taking away your choice so they could control who was in that Oval Office. And they have sold you out by taking control. Because this is why I'm telling you, folks, when you look at the parties, I've said this before, the party is twofold. You've got the grassroots and you got the political party. Those who are in office that represent the party and those who represent the grassroots and you, the voters, and they do not meet. In other words, the grassroots party system that you're involved in is lipstick on the pig, because the people that are in office representing the party do not care what you think is important. They are doing what they're being paid to do. And that's why we're in this mess, because we've allowed all of our elections to be sold and paid for by the globalists. This is why we really, this is a very straightforward argument, and a lot of people look at this as a very complicated matter, and it's not. Elections need to be localized. Elections need to go down to your counties, to the legislative, to the area of the election. Right now, the congressional district is what it is. But if we start demanding and we restore our republicanism, and we actually go, because if we went to 15,000 folks, if we went to 15,000 and moved that number from 30,000 down to 15,000 voters, then let me tell you what that number would be. If we had 15,000 representatives, not to exceed 15,000 voters, that would mean 2,087 counties in America, two-thirds of all counties would have at least one representative, at least one. Do you believe you'd be better represented in Congress and your voice would be heard if that person came from your county? Absolutely. And it's the same thing with your electors. If you choose the elector, then your state cannot choose. As I said, the Constitution does not allow your state legislatures to choose the outcomes, and that's what they've been doing, because the parties have convinced everybody, and because we've been blinded by the parties, we're in a huge mess. Petitions is the way out. Holding your public servants directly accountable to their oath of office is the only way forward. I'm here to help. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.